My name's Eric, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, family. My sobriety date's 4/20 of 2004. My home group's the Sunday morning men's meeting at the Now Club on West Strickland Street in Douglasville, Georgia. Do I need to stand a little bit closer?
Yes, sir.
I'm intimidated. I'm already scared, y'all. Okay, we're good? Excellent. So first and foremost, I want to thank Creator for another day and a new promise and another opportunity. And I'm just going to ask Him to be in my mind and in my thinking and in my mouth and in my speaking. Because at the end of the day, this is what it's all about. And my journey to my Creator and a pathway to peace. I want to thank the committee for trusting me enough to get up here. You never know what can come out of my mouth sometimes, and so I have to be mindful of that. And so, Sissy, I love you a lot, and I thank the world of you, and Harry Bryant and Maurice and the other people that helped put this together. Y'all have been helping me come down here for at least 8 years now, and I am thankful and grateful for that. I want to thank my sponsor for coming down here this morning. Dude, that's huge. About made me start crying. You know, but that's what we do for each other. And what y'all told me is, what am I willing to do for my recovery today? Am I willing to go to any lengths, or am I just willing to settle for, rest on my laurels, my past achievements? And in my opinion, I don't really think that I've achieved a whole lot in recovery. Now, with that being said, God has achieved a lot. And I credit everything that I am today to Creator, this program, and you folks. And that's where it's at for me. Have I forgotten anything so far? Okay, keep going. I have to check with my boss. And I thank my wife for putting up with me for so long and helping me stay right-sized. Yeah, she's a big supporter of me, and I don't know where I'd be without her today. So thank you, and I love you. So where do I start? Share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, right? And, you know, there's a whole lot of what it was like, and there's a whole lot of what's going on today. And the message that I hope to convey to the newcomer is that we can do this deal together. There is hope here for the desperate, you know, and what are we willing to do for it is what it boils down to. And so I grew up in a small town, and I believed that my parents loved me. I grew up in a Catholic home, and went through all the things that a good Catholic does, and catechism school and communion school and all that jazz. And it was always in the back of my mind that God was never there. Found out at an early age that the Easter Bunny didn't exist, that Santa Claus didn't exist, and all the other things that didn't exist. So why did God exist? It was just another lie to kind of keep me under wraps, you know. And it never resonated within me. And I believe that at an early age, I always had a God problem, you know. And so as time progressed and I got older, what I want to share is tragic events in my life that helped me decide that what I wanted to do was become an alcoholic full time. And so, at the age of 13, all three of my grandfathers passed away. My father was diagnosed with HIV, and my grandmother shot herself in the head and left her in a vegetable state. That was a good reason. And so I started learning to medicate. And that continued for a good while. And I'm one of those strange and real alcoholics. And I will do my best to maintain singleness of purpose, because I grew up AA. And although I visit other fellowships, my home has always been in AA. And I have a fond love and respect for these rooms and the traditions. And so anything that I hope that I refer to from here on out, if it's alcohol, know that it's a symptom of my disease and that it's all inclusive. Okay? So with that being said, at the age of 17 years old, my father passed away and from his disease, and my grandmother passed away, and that kind of gave me carte blanche to just go ahead and proceed living the life that I wanted to live. And somewhere in the interim, I ran into an individual that led me on a darker path. And what it did was afforded me the opportunity to live the life that I wanted to live without repercussions in my mind. I got to be my own God. I got to do what I wanted to do. And if you did to me what I did to you, I would hurt you. You're supposed to respect me. I don't have to respect you. You know, because I'm God in my world. If y'all stop breathing my air, my world would be better. And that's how I lived my life for a long time. Pretty much from 17 to 29, my life was a blur. I'm a blackout drinker. From the first time I got drunk, I blacked out. Consequences were never enough for me. I woke up several times with my face and my hair matted to the floor from throw up. In vehicles, I had no idea why I was in that vehicle or why I was where I was at. Several times I've left places and didn't know how I got home. You know, but the last time was significantly different. I remember what I can of that time. It's horrible, but it's my past. And it does not dictate my future. What it has done is the book has told me that what I've become is willing to face and rectify my errors and turn them into assets. And so as a result of, I woke up in a jail cell wondering why I was there again for the 200th time, because, you know, that was my second home. I knew when I needed a break, I'd just go get in trouble and go to jail and everything would be okay. This time was a little bit different. I didn't get the welcoming committee that I normally got. I didn't get to go immediately on trustee. They wanted nothing to do with me, and they told me the best place I needed to do was just go to the hole, be left alone, and get this stuff over and done with and get out of their jail as quickly as possible. I'm like, what? You know? And so I made up my mind there that it would probably be better off for me to just die. And I prayed every day for God to take me. And I prayed those prayers several times throughout my drinking career. It just never worked out. You know, there were several times in my history to where people put guns to my head and I was begging them to blow my brains out because I was too much of a coward to do it on my own. And, it's funny how life turns around, you know, and God shows up. And I never knew then that God had a purpose for me. I never knew then that I would be standing here before you today, bearing myself, making myself feel vulnerable, giving you ammunition to push my buttons, you know. And it's just what we do today. It's what I do today. It's what helps me stay sober. And so when I finally got to the prison, I remember the first honest prayer I've ever prayed to a God of my misunderstanding. And it was basically, I don't know if you're out there. I don't know if you exist. But make this hard enough on me to where I get something. And when I got to where I was going, I got to Lee State Prison. And I served 3 years there. And when I got there, I proceeded to get drunk. What does good alcoholic do? We numb out the pain, right? And so from April to June 30th of 2003, I got drunk. But in the interim of all that, God showed up. And there was a roommate of mine that said, hey, maybe you ought to come check out these meetings up the way. free coffee, free food sometimes, and hey, it don't hurt. You get out of the dorm, and I started hearing things that I needed to hear. You know, like, this program's not for sissies. I needed to hear that. I needed to hear, keep coming back. Bring your butt, the rest show up, you know, and it's hard, but it's fair. That's been a hard pill to swallow here lately. And then hopefully I'll be able to get to that. I wanted nothing to do with God while I was there at that point in time. But when I got my first sponsor, he's like, you know what? There's a library up there. There's a plethora of books. Go up there and find your God. Find what resonates within you. And so in the interim of all that, I started going back to church, and I even got to check out the Islamic services while I was there, some of the other services that they offered, and got in vocational school for education. And so at the end of the day, my first higher power was a person in these rooms. He had what I wanted. He showed me something that I've never been shown before, that I've never really looked for in another human being. And at the end of the day, he wanted to love me, and I didn't know why. He come and took time out of his busy day to spend an hour with us and all the things that he had to go through to get into there. And that meant a lot to me. That stood out to me, and that was my first epiphany in these rooms. And as time progressed, that relationship started growing together, and I respected that, you know. And Harry was coming in, Johnny was coming in, Lee was coming in, and I've got to meet a lot of great people, and I'm like, why are these folks coming up here? Why am I so special? Because I don't know about y'all, it's all about me. You know, why are they coming up here for me? And so I just started listening. And I started working some steps, and April 19th of 2004, I got some letters from home. They were pretty tragic, in a sense. One was a Dear John letter. The other one was, my mom got beat up by my stepfather. And I'm like, I know what makes that go away. So I got drunk again. And I remember going in and telling my sponsor, and he's like, lay down. And I woke up the next day, and I haven't had a drink since. Now, I want to share something special with you, because God, at that point in time, has always been suiting up and showing up for me. 420 for some of y'all is a special day. 420 for me is my grandfather's birthday, who died with double-digit sobriety in these rooms. That's how God was already working in my life. Okay? And I say sometimes that I got drunk on my four-step. I didn't get drunk on my four-step. I got drunk because I wanted to get drunk. Because I didn't know how to cope with the hurts and the pains. Although I said I was working, I wasn't doing the work. So then I started getting busy and started working the steps. And it started being life-changing for me. I started seeing something show up in my life. And it wasn't on Mondays and Thursdays anymore. It was every day of the week, you know. And I remember being out on the crosswalk at Lee State Prison. And for some reason, in the middle of the day, which is unheard of, I was by myself and I felt truly free. And I believe on that particular day, I don't know what day that it was, but I remember that day specifically, and I felt free, and I looked around, and inside of a prison system with Constantine wire all around me, I felt like I could just fly away, you know? Then the day came that I get to go home, and I was talking with a friend of mine about a resentment that I had against a family member, and I'm like, you know, if I get an opportunity, I'm going to handle it. And he's like, well, you're coming back. I'm like, okay, well, then maybe I need to change that. Because, see, y'all told me, if the same man that comes in the room doesn't change, he's going to get drunk again. So if y'all sobered me up, but I didn't want to change yet, and I had a lot of anger and resentments and fears and all the things that come along with with the past as I'd been living it, and judgments, opinions, thoughts, and just ways that I was taught as a kid and as a young adult. And so I get out, and immediately upon being released, I feel like Mike Tyson has me by my throat, and he's squeezing very hard. And didn't know what that was at first, but it was anxiety. I was having an anxiety attack. And when I got to my home, bless her heart, my mother said, "Here's something to help you feel better." And I said, "I can't do that. Whatever it is that's going on with me, it will work itself out." And that had set a stage ever since. I had to go for psychological evaluations and get all the tests and stuff like that. And at the end of the test, this individual informed me that I had all kinds of issues. Alcohol, drugs, ADHD, CFP, whatever all those things are, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And he immediately wanted to put me on prescription pills, and he wanted to medicate me. And I said, "You know what? I've been sober this long." At that point, I was around a year, year and a half. I was released in August of 2005. And I told him, "Let's see how I do without it for a little while. And if it gets to be to a certain point to where it looks like I need to be medicated, then we'll readdress the issues." And I started going to classes and stuff like that. And then I started going to these A&A classes on the outside, right? Yeah. So I get my paper signed. And funny thing is I didn't have to get my paper signed this time. When I was 17 years old and first got introduced to the program, I had to get a paper signed then. But I wasn't about recovery then. I was 17 years old. I knew everything. It was... you know, I didn't have a problem. Y'all had the problem. You know, I was hanging out with folks older than me, badder than me, and teaching me how to live the life that I thought that I wanted to live. You know, I've been running with outlaw motorcycle clubs for the most of my life, and I thought that was cool, but I never fit in. I come here, and I fit in immediately, you know. And in my addiction, everywhere I went, there I was, but I didn't fit, you know, hanging out with motorcycle clubs, hanging out with the gangbangers down in Atlanta, hanging out with just whomever, as there I was. But I always felt like the outsider looking in. Y'all offered me the opportunity to be the insider looking out. You know, and I'm thankful and grateful for that. Y'all told me I can get as far in the center as I want to go, and there I can find God. And y'all are all around me. And I've taken that to heart. And in the interim, Larry Hines offered me one of the most important opportunities in my life that I can ever... I'm truly grateful for what he told me. He said, "God is everything or he's nothing." So is that all-inclusive? Because it says in the book that he doesn't make too hard of terms for those who seek him. I took that literal, and as a result of, God found me at an A&A meeting one night and invited me out to a ceremony. And I practice Native American spirituality, mostly Lakota Sioux ceremonies, and that's how God resonates within me. It's different. Not everybody gets it. You know, but what y'all taught me is I can't put limits on God. God is limitless. He's all-inclusive, never exclusive. And miracles started showing up in my life. I met my wife at an A&A meeting. And I say that she 13th stepped me, but she didn't. She's She's just a beautiful soul, and as soon as I saw her, I was immediately attracted. And 2 years later, we were getting together. And I would like to say that I waited patiently, but I didn't. What I did in early recovery was wreak havoc and discontent to myself and to other people in the rooms. That's a good way of putting that, right, Miles? And I don't suggest that. You know, y'all taught me that, you know, try not to get into a relationship your first year in recovery. Well, that was my first year on the outside. And I got an outside sponsor, and he told me that I just wanted to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And when's the man going to change on the inside? I'm like, well, aren't I entitled to have a little bit of fun because of all the years that I've been locked up, you know? And he's like, your ego is going to kill you. And I never understood that. I just thought he was hating. And, you know, I get out of prison. I'm 230 pounds, and I feel good. I'm working out every day, doing the things that I... Feeding the ego is what I was doing. I was feeding the ego. And I could justify just about anything except a drink or a drug. And what I later found out is I was causing a lot of harm to my soul and to other people's soul. And I had to answer for that. It didn't come up until later on, a few years later, to where I finally got honest enough when there was some severe consequences coming that I didn't want to hurt like that no more. And so I had to get all that stuff out. You know, I heard Dave and Polly talk about relationships in these rooms, and I've met a lot of great people in here. And in doing step work, I found freedom for myself. And what I want to do is I want to find freedom for you too. And I can't work your program as much as I want to. You know, I call my sponsor. My sponsor calls me. My sponsor has probably called me more times in the last few months than I have called him. That man and that young lady right there before me know everything about me in my life. Everything. Nothing's left out. And if I happen to have made a wall that has been built up and it comes down at some point, that man gets a call. I can't sit on none of that. Secrets are keep me sick, you know, and I have to tell on myself no matter what. And it's sometimes it's a tall order. Sometimes I don't want to do the work. I want to sit in it, and I want to do the things that I want to do, and hopefully, instead of asking for permission, I get to ask for forgiveness, but it don't work that way sometimes, you know? There's some things that I'm getting ready to talk about that's going to be very hard for me, and if my eyes go to leaking, I'm not crying. They're just watering a little bit. I've met a lot of good people in here, and when I first started coming around, a certain individual came back from Birmingham, Alabama, and she was the first woman in recovery that I had a platonic relationship with. And she loved me warts and all, no matter what, to the moon and back. And she called me on my stuff quicker than anybody else. And we shared a lot of good years together. Kim was one of those ones that was willing to go to any lengths to do the deal. Was over committed to these rooms, went above and beyond, and I know that I'm telling a little bit of her story, but her story is valid. She helped people pay their bills. She watched their kids. She come over to our house, and we, you know, we hung out, we dinnered, we went to meetings. She and I prayed together for several years, doing ceremonies. And um, some things changed in her life. Found a relationship and had been talking to my wife and I about some controlled drinking. And, you know, it only takes one mess up to get rid of all your 100 attaboys. And she decided to go back out. Year and a half later, we're burying her. December 4th of last year, she OD'd. And it has rocked our recovery community. But my perception of that is she showed me how to live a program 100% and how to do it, and she showed me how not to do it. And it's been hard. It's been real hard. You know, in the past few months, actually since Thanksgiving, we put a lot of people on the ground up in our community and around our community. I started on Thanksgiving. A young man decided it was better for him to taste the business end of a gun rather than to sort his stuff out. And it started all barreling downhill from that. A young lady of 29 years old OD'd a few weeks ago. I got a call at 3:30 in the morning. And I'm going to tell you something. Materials don't mean nothing to me. What means something to me is somebody thinks enough of me to call me at 3:30 in the morning to come help them. That's the juice for me. Thanks enough of me to do their fist step with me and be open and honest and tell me something that they've never told me before or told anybody else for that matter. That's what this deal does. We're there for each other. And what I remember is y'all was there for me. And what am I willing to do for you? Because at the end of the day, we're all God's kids, right? Just trying to make our way. The past few months have rocked my wife and I. And you know what we did? We got busy. We started working steps, started calling sponsors, started getting sponsees, started going to more meetings. We picked our game up. Because I don't know about y'all, but folks dying with 10, 20, 30 years in sobriety, that kind of rocks me a little bit. Where am I at? What am I doing? Trust God, clean house, help others. Am I putting my personalities before my principles? And I have regrets. I feel like I failed my friend. That why didn't I step up at some point in some time and tell her how much that I loved her and that I care about her and that I don't want her to die an alcoholic's death? Big Book tells me what to do when working with others. Somebody don't want it, go to somebody else. My sponsor taught me, God brings y'all to me. My gift back to God is when we separate and go about our ways. That's been hard for Kim, you know. I can honestly say that when I read that story in the back of the book of the third edition, Rum, Radio, and Rebellion, where it says that this gentleman has been through many more things in AA than he'd ever been in his drinking career. I can honestly say that today. And it's been hard, but it's been fair. And I've gotten a lot more grace and mercy than I deserve. You know, a lot of miracles in my life, you know. And like Dave said, it's all the ones that I can see behind me because we can't see the miracles coming. And I have to remember that. I'm a miracle. I know that I am. One thing that I do want to relate is that, you know, I do come from an alcoholic family. And December 12th of 2013, I got to see the direct result of untreated alcoholism in my face, and it was horrible. My uncle had been Atlanta PD for 31 years, retired, started doing security work, and he decided that it was better for him to start drinking. And 2 weeks prior to December 12th, my mother and I went over to his apartment to pick him up off the floor because he had been there for 4 hours. And as I helped him up and got him to his chair, I noticed that he was shaking violently, you know. And we know that as the DTs, right? And I went to the kitchen amidst his sea of empty Jack Daniels bottles and poured him a drink. And my mother the whole time telling me, "What are you doing? Are you crazy?" And I'm like, "No, I get it." I poured that man a drink. And when he took that drink, he stopped shaking. Then I got to talk to him a little bit about A&A. And he said, "I think I'd like to go." I said, "Okay." 2 weeks later, my mother and I went back to his apartment where we found him dead with a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. And that's the first time I've seen something like that in recovery. Up close, personal, family member. But for the grace of God, there go I. That could have been me. That could have been you. All these folks dying from untreated alcoholism, that could be us. Today, tomorrow. What am I willing to do for my recovery today? Freddie B. tells me, "Am I impressed with my recovery?" I'm asking you, are you impressed with yours? I'm impressed with my God. He loves me unconditionally. You know, and that in and of itself is awesome. In 2009, I believe it was late July, early August, my belief of a God went from a belief or faith to a knowing. And that's mine. Y'all can't take that from me. We do a ceremony called Sundance up at Rosebud, South Dakota, and there's Sundances all over. Since we're Sioux, we go to South Dakota. It's the Northern Plains Tribe. Anyway, during Sundance, there's some particular things that we do, and it's symbolical, and I hook to a tree. There's pins in my chest, and it reenacts the umbilical cord, okay? And I remember crying, and I remember praying, "God, I can't do this. I don't have the strength to do this." And basically what you do is you pull those pins free from your chest, and you offer skin as a sacrifice, okay? And I know y'all don't get it. That probably sounds pretty barbaric. But in our beliefs, our skin is our only possession. And to give that up is good. It's washte. And washte wakan. And it's holy good. And so that last time I was coming back, I had the people around me. And I remember saying, "God, I can't do this. God, I can't do this. Please help me." And I see a hand come down, smack me on this chest. The pin pulls free. I see another hand come down, hit me on this side. Pin pulls free. I get back into camp, and I'm like, "Johnny, why'd Jeff slap me free?" And he's like, "Man, nobody touched you." I'm like, "Yeah, dude, I saw him." He's like, "I'm telling you, we were behind you, dude. There was nobody around you. So just take it for what it was." On that day is when my belief went to a knowing. God exists in my life. God has brought me this far, has not dropped me on my head. And what, you know, fear of financial insecurity and people and economics and all that jazz, that don't bother me. You know, there's some financial stuff that bothers my wife sometimes. And I'm of the opinion that I came from nothing materialistically, and if I go back there, I'm all right. God loves me no matter what. Since I've been out of prison, I've had clothes on my back. I've had food over my head. All the things that was necessary to survive, You know what? And a year after my wife and I got married, we bought our first home. We're in a position to where we own our vehicles now and just bought a new one. And new to me, it's a 89 GMC Sierra. But again, we've got the material stuff. We've got the house, the roof over our head. We've got the cars. We've motorcycle had, it goes back to what are we willing to do? My brother got in some legal issues, and it was best for me to sell my bike than for him to sell his motorcycle. You know, that bike, while he built it, we built it, it's not that important. He's more important. God's kids are more important than anything else in my life today. I will walk off my job for you. I will spend my money for you if necessary. And I walked off jobs before. It don't bother me. They come back. Money's not real. It's an illusion. God's kids are real. So everything that I've ever gotten in these rooms that's ever important to me is y'all's love. Y'all's relationships that teach me how to grow and become a man. The intimacy that I share with my wife and being able to bare my soul, and it has nothing to do with sex. I never knew that. Just saying. She and I went to some counseling for a little bit, and because we needed it, you know. We have to become healthy, right? I can't speak for her, but I'm selfishness and self-centeredness to the extreme. And I had to learn how to listen to her, how to validate her feelings, you know. And it's been hard. I'm still working on it. You know, I have to listen to her love languages, you know, and we get the opportunity of raising our son who has never seen us in active addiction and grow up that way. And he seems to be doing just fine and adjusting very well. My daughter, on the other hand, she's 17 from a previous relationship. I have a younger son that's 12 from a previous relationship, both from the same parenting co-partner. And which, by the way, she and I have a great relationship. It's better off for us to be friends than together and miserable, you know. But our 17-year-old daughter is living with us, and she's driving both of us crazy. But what I want to say is there's a miracles in that, because what she has seen is she's seen me fight, she's seen me get stabbed, she's seen guns pointed at my head, she's seen shots go off in houses, she's seen me drink a lot. Now she gets to see me doing the deal sober, one day at a time. She has enough faith and trust in her daddy to come say, "Hey, Dad, what do you think about this? I'm getting ready to do this." And we had the big talk, when she was 13 or 14. "I'm getting ready to have sex, Dad." I'm like, "I don't want to hear that." That's God working in my life to let me know that my daughter loves me enough and trusts me enough to come and talk to me about something like that. So I said, "Okay, let's be proactive. Please do not do anything before we go see your doctor and get you on birth control. That's not giving you free rein to go out there and do whatever it is you're wanting to do. All I'm saying is, you know, let's be proactive." And her mother and I got together. Her mother was strongly against it. And I'm like, "Okay, birth control, pregnancy, birth control." Oh, not a hard decision, you know, for the alcoholic. You know, a doomed life or a spiritual life. We're the only ones in society that I believe actually weighs that. The bitter end or an alcoholic solution to, you know, a spiritual solution, you know? And So my daughter talks to me about things like that. My daughter talks to my wife about things like that. And we offer a safe house. Now, has she respected that? No. But I love her enough to let her be a human being and make her own mistakes and let her know that she can do anything she wants to in her life as long as she's willing to face the consequences. That's what I tell myself. That's what I tell my kids. That's what I tell my sponsees and friends. Why do I tell people that? Because y'all taught me that. I remember at one point when I was home, I called Harry. What's up, old buddy? I love that man. I love you, man. And I called Harry, and I was madder than a hornet. I was getting ready to hurt somebody. And he said, ha, 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 ha. Let me know how that works out for you. You can do whatever you want to, as long as you're willing to face the consequences for it. I'm like, you know what? I don't want to call you no more. What y'all have given me in any situation is the moment of clarity to make a certain choice or decision. Recently on a job, doing a 2,200 square feet tile job in Kennesaw, I got very angry with one of my workers and was ready to pounce. Because I don't know about you guys, I can detect moments of weakness, and I can be intimidating when I want to. And oh, is the cops here? I didn't do that. Anyway, that moment of clarity happened in my life to where I was able to remove myself from that situation. And my first phone call was my sponsor, but his phone's been going to voicemail lately. So I called my wife, and she said, yeah, you need to call somebody else because I can't help you. So the next person that I called for him to validate what I was going through. I called him to co-sign my stuff so I could go back there and justifiably handle that individual. What he told me was I can do whatever I want to as well, and I'm long to face the consequences. And I almost hung up on him. What he told me is God gave me a choice and a split-second decision that my brother wishes he would have done in his situation, because he reacted to a situation that landed him where he's at today. Had I previously, before sobriety, if somebody upset me, I would hurt them. I would hurt people before they hurt me, because that's the way I was taught. You're inevitably all going to hurt me one day, so if I hurt you and get you far enough away from me, I won't have to worry about you. How are we doing on time? 3 minutes? Who can? As I look back on my life, I have been richly blessed and, in my opinion, highly favored. I'm one of God's special kids, and I believe that, and I love feeling that way. I know that anywhere I go, God is there with me, envelops me, loves me. And before I got up here this morning, I was like, yay, nobody's here. That's awesome. But extremely nervous, terrified, all the things that make me vulnerable. And, as soon as I said the prayer when we started going, that all dissipated. And I don't know where I would be without you guys today. Y'all have done more for me than I will ever be able to do for you. So I keep suiting up and showing up. And I don't say no. And if you're here today and you've lost your way, keep coming back. God doesn't make too hard of terms on those who seek Him. And we're seekers. I seek God every day. When I wake up to the time that I go to bed, I see Him in you. I see Him in the trees, in the sun, in the gentle wind that blows, or the hawk that was sitting across the street this morning when I went out to smoke a cigarette to let me know that everything's going to be all right. God shows up for me. Sponsor shows up for me. That's awesome, dude. Man drove 3.5 hours to get here. I love that guy. That's what we do for each other, right? And so if at any time, in any place, if I can help, please let me be of service. Nobody's told y'all today. God loves you and I love you, and there ain't nothing you can do about it. Thanks for letting me share.